And Ronald, thank you so very much for taking time to visit with us about your unique journey across the plains this spring. Tell me a little bit about this road trip and how it all came about.
Well, I have a blogging partner at our grandfather's grainelevators.com, and she bought a used pickup for her teenage son. She bought this here in Southern California where I live, and I agreed to deliver the truck, a 27-year-old Ford pickup, to them in Illinois where they live. But I only got as far as Omaha, which is my own hometown, and I had some mechanical problems. So I left the truck there in Nebraska with her father, who lives right outside Omaha. Convenient, very convenient. But as long as I was doing this road trip, I wanted to swing through the Texas Panhandle and western Oklahoma and visit as many grain elevators as I could, because my grandfather built a lot of them. So I was visiting about 20 of the elevators that Tillotson Construction Company of Omaha built from between 1939 in Goltree, Oklahoma, and up to 55 is when the records end. But most of the elevators I visited were built right after World War II and in the early 50s.
So tell me how your grandfather got involved in designing and building grain elevators.
Yeah, that's it's an interesting story. The Tillotson Construction Company built wooden elevators up and through the 30s. And then my great-grandfather, Charles H. Tillotson, died in 38, leaving the company to his sons, Reginald, my grandfather, and Joe, my great-uncle. And that was in 38. They put their heads together and decided the future really was not in wooden elevators, but reinforced concrete. And so they figured out how to build these things. And in 39, they got a commission in Goltree, Oklahoma, to do one. And so it was their first. And it was a 60,000 bushel elevator, which by current standards is puny. But, you know, you can imagine they went up, the silos went 96 feet, and then we call it the cupola or head house went up another 23 feet on top. And so they were going up with these wooden forms that they'd built and trying to stay level and pouring concrete inside the forms as they rose. And it must have been a real test of nerves for the crew in order to keep everything level and get the concrete finished properly as they poured it and so on.
So that Goltree elevator was the first reinforced concrete grain elevator in Oklahoma. Was that also one of the first in the country?
Well, I don't know if it was the first in Oklahoma. It was the first that Tillotson Construction Company built.
Okay.
And they just happened to get the job in Oklahoma. And then they duplicated that same elevator in Newkirk and Douglas in 1940 and 41. Same 60,000 bushels, exact same plan. And then they really didn't build any more elevators until 44, 45. And they devised unique plans for those sites as well, so that by 45 in Farnsworth, Texas, they built a 350,000 bushel elevator, which is huge. But I think the first concrete elevators started to be built. I mean, there were a couple of terminals like in Duluth and New York, I believe, that were built real early in the 20th century when reinforced concrete was just a new building method. And I think for country elevators, it was more like the mid-30s. There was a big company out of Salina called Johnson Construction, and they built probably the greatest number of elevators in the prairies and Great Plains. And I think they started in 34. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of demand in the mid-30s because of the Great Depression. But by the end of the decade, farmers co-ops were looking for more storage than they had in those wooden elevators, which generally only went 75 or 90 feet up.
So the switch from wood to reinforced concrete was really about expanding that capacity.
Yes, right. And then they'd build an elevator, which they'd call the main house, and then they'd go build a storage complex next to it with, you know, 10 more silos that could hold a couple hundred thousand bushels of grain. So they'd more than double their capacity out of the elevator, and that became very typical. So you see those storage annexes stringing out on the landscape next to the main elevator.
We're speaking with Ronald Ahrens about the rise of grain elevators on the plains today. And Ronald, I was particularly struck by your blog's description of these elevators as grain castles and the fact that they really do serve as a defining landmark for a lot of towns on the plains. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that hit me as I got into, like, my first stop in Oklahoma was Shattuck in western part of the state, and then I went to Orienta. Tillotson Construction built in Orienta. Shattuck, I just stopped because I liked what I saw there. But, you know, you can imagine 1933, the tallest structures out in those towns were the wooden elevators, 75, 90 feet high. And then between mid-30s and mid-50s, the whole landscape was transformed so that every little town had a grain elevator, maybe a couple. And they went as high as, some of them went up to 175 feet. So, you know, every town now had a landmark, and you could see them 6-7 miles away.
So how many Oklahoma towns did you visit on your journey, and did you have a favorite Oklahoma grain elevator?
A favorite grain elevator? Well, I'd have to say the favorite was the one in Goltry, because it was my grandfather's very first one. And I liked what I found in Meno, where it turned out, I think the Tillotson Construction Company built two grain elevators right side by side a few years apart. And that was a surprise. I think the second one isn't in the company records, which end in 55. So maybe they built it in 56 or so. And gee, I don't know. I mean, I love visiting small towns, you know, and that was part of the pleasure of this road trip. I was in Helena, and the wind was blowing so hard I could hardly stand still to take photos. And I went to Pond Creek on the way out of Oklahoma as I headed north, and met some great people there, who really astute people, who told me the elevators there were holding up okay despite earthquakes, which are a new phenomenon, I guess, in Oklahoma. And you know, they talked about practical issues with these buildings are really toward the end of what the insurance companies would call their rated lives. You know, they're having to deal with a lot of issues, cracks in the concrete, and the internal mechanisms which need to be refreshed or replaced and so on. And in fact, the elevator in Goltry, the 1939 elevator, hasn't been operational for about 10 years because of leaks in the silo and the silos and problems with the man lift. There's a tiny little elevator inside each of these. I'm talking about a lift, you know, that type of elevator inside the big elevator for a crew member to go all the way up to the head house and do maintenance on the equipment up there, and also go into what they call the run, which extends across onto the top of the annex, the storage annex. So, you know, another problem was with the leg, which is the means of getting the grain out of the pit below the elevator up up to the very top and then to distribute into silos. The leg is typically a six-ply belt, a fabric belt that's 14 inches wide and has cups on it, 12 inches across by 6 inches deep. And the cups scoop the grain out of the pit below the main slab and carry it up to the top and dump it up there. And those the belts have worn out, I guess, in Goltry, and so the leg wasn't operational anymore.
That's fascinating. I would assume, and I know there have been stories about some of the dangers involved with working in a grain elevator. I'm assuming the same would apply to building them as well.
Oh yeah, it was. We have a whole chapter on our blog about the danger, and people died building these things. Men died, and men also survived some pretty hairy situations, which we have some accounts of. All three of my Tillets and uncles, are still living. They're in their early 80s and late 70s, and they worked for my grandfather. My uncle Chuck, who's 82 or 3, went to work as an apprentice carpenter when he was 12. And he spent a lot of his teen years hanging off the edges of elevators as they built them. And they also had to, once they were built, they had to put a whitewash coating on the exterior. And they would do this from a flying scaffold, which was held just really a couple of boards that were held in place with rope on the top, coming from the top of the elevator and weighted down with sandbags. And you can imagine blowing around on a breezy summer day, painting, whitewashing the side of an elevator. And there's one story about how guys were doing this, I think, in Lincoln, Nebraska, and the roofers came to work. And they were clearing off everything, so they lifted the sandbags up, and two guys plunged to their deaths.
You talk about some of these structures no longer being operational. Are they being torn down? Are they just abandoned? What's the long term future for these abandoned elevators?
You know, I don't think there's a consensus about that. In Goltry, the 1939 elevator is just standing there, closed up. It's, you know, the farmers' co-ops really don't have enough money, I think, to do a demolition project, which is with, you're talking about, you know, several, let's see, Goltry had 32.5 tons of steel inside, reinforcing the concrete, and you have to, you know, these things don't come apart very easily. So it would be a long, expensive demolition project. And I think the easiest thing to do is just let them stand there. I mean, there's a big, big Tillotson elevator in Omaha that hasn't been in use for decades. And it's, you know, people have tried to figure out, like, make a climbing center out of it for adventure climbers, and it doesn't pay off. You know, it's hard to make them find a secondary use that pays off.
Although I did read in your blog, it sounds like there is an individual looking to repurpose an elevator as a vertical farm. What's that all about?
Yeah, I heard from those guys, and they were all ambitious to produce vegetables with, you know, artificial light, and they have lots of space to work with inside an elevator. That was in Joplin, Missouri, perhaps, or Springfield, one of those two. And I hadn't received any updates from them whether their project's taken off. I also just heard from the historical preservation officer in Tempe, Arizona, where we have an elevator. It was a Mayor Osborne elevator, and that's my blogging partner's grandfather. And there, evidently, a developer has that elevator now, and there's a mill also right in downtown Tempe, and they're going to make a hotel out of it.
Oh, wow.
That's what they say.
Wow, interesting. And there's also an effort underway with, and I believe this is in Omaha, grain elevator serving as a large canvas, if you will, for artwork.
That was a project. I can't remember the name of it, but they wanted to acknowledge the harvest, you know, and they commissioned artists to do these banners that draped down the silos. And it was a great project. It ended a couple years ago and they took the banners off. And I was at the end of my road trip in April, I ended up in Omaha and visited that elevator. And it's gone back to being dormant, except that graffiti artists have discovered it. And I'm talking about really high quality graffiti, you know, murals, really. So people are painting the lower parts of the the silos, but you know, someone owns that elevator and just can't figure out any economic use for it.
You mentioned some of the people that you met along the journey. You logged a lot of miles. Can you talk a little bit about overall the reception that you received as you traveled from place to place, and some of the unique individuals that you met along the way?
Yeah, I can't tell you how many miles I drove because the odometer in that truck wasn't working. But you know, like one of my last stops was in Pond Creek, and I met Kent Prickett, who is vice president and general manager of Farmers Grain Company. And he was so articulate in telling me about, he said that he called the elevators old girls. And he said the earthquakes haven't been kind to the old girls. And then he went on and talked to me about, you know, the rated life of these elevators and dealing with insurance companies and trying to keep them working. I mean, for the most part, they do continue to work pretty well. Just need, you know, a little fixing here and there with some of that equipment. But, so that was one guy I met. And I also enjoyed the people I met in Mino, which was, Matthew Thompson and Tracy Rhodes were in the office there at the co-op. And, you know, Matthew, they were both really bright people and real eager to show me around and receptive to the news. You know, basically people at these elevators don't know the history of the buildings too well. And when you show up with company records, then you can tell them that their elevator, you know, held so many such and such bushels. I mean, they may already know that, but, you know, and how many cubic yards of concrete and how many tons of reinforcing steel went into it and all of those specs. You know, they were pretty happy to hear from me.
Ronald, after you completed your journey, did you take the opportunity to really think back and collectively ponder how much grain has been grown, stored, and shipped from this part of the country and what that's meant to our nation's history?
I did, actually. I came across an essay by a geographer, and he was a University of Oklahoma PhD candidate who wrote a really good essay about how Enid had become the grain capital of the United States with millions of bushels of storage for shipment by rail. And he had told the story of how the city fathers of Enid, you know, wangled the railroad to come through Enid in the first place. And I think that era has somewhat passed, but yeah, you know, by the 60s and 70s, we had all this capacity and tremendous production from the land. And yeah, I did think about what a miracle, really, it all is.
How did this journey help you connect personally to memories of your father and grandfather?
Yeah, my grandfather, this is on my mother's side of the family, Reginald Tillotson, died when I was 5 years old, so I didn't know him too well. That was about 1960. And so it's been, you know, we didn't, as a family, we didn't really know that much about the elevators because they were built in from North Dakota to South Carolina. And we didn't even realize that the one in Omaha was our own, so to speak. And so this whole endeavor, the blog that we've done for 6 years and the road trip that I finally got to do, I've been wanting to do this forever, did bring it all a lot closer. And being able to look at the company records too and interpret, you know, what they did here and what they did there, it really is a meaningful experience for me, and I hope that comes through in the writing on our grandfather's grainelevators.com. I've tried to mix in a little bit that I find about the history of the towns and you know, for example, Mino, Oklahoma, really was named for Menno Simons, who was the leader of the Mennonites, and somebody misspelled Mino on an application when they were incorporating the town. They left out one N, and it became Mino. So there's little bonuses like that too, but you know, the connection with the larger story, that was big time for me.
And what do you hope that people who visit your blog come away with after looking at the photos and reading the blog post entries?
Well, I hope that they have a new awareness about their surroundings. You know, I think these elevators tend to become almost invisible because they're everywhere, and you know, a lot of them are a little shabby, and you know, you don't think too much about them, but they do have individual architectural differences that evolved. The different builders evolved their own styles. And you see it especially with the cupolas or the headhouses, and also things like where the driveway is located so that trucks could come into the elevator and dump their grain right there into the pit, or some had driveways on the side. And so there are differences in the architectural styles, and that's one thing that people could look for. And in the other thing really is just all the tradition that these buildings represent, and how they're part of the story of the increased prosperity of the Great Plains and prairies,
Is there anything you'd like to add to our conversation today? I know you'd like to talk a little bit about your blog and how you could support it.
Oh yeah, I finance this trip myself, and I can't afford to do that all the time. And I just dream about that somebody will come forward and sponsor us, like one of these big grain companies or something. And we could then do more road trips and visit more elevators because they're all over the place. And also get into some historical archives, because I'm sure there have to be records, you know, that the state has kept about building permits and, you know, all those things, and local news stories too, about, you know, these elevators, when they went up in small towns, it was a big event and everybody paid attention to all the details. They'd go up in about 10 weeks. So, you know, it was a big transformation for each of those towns, and local papers covered that stuff. So I would like to one day, you know, get a little backing on this and do some more work.
Well, again, a fascinating look at really at small town America, and the important role that grain elevators have played in our nation's history. Ronald Ahrens, thank you so very much for taking the time to visit with us today. And again, if you're interested in learning more about this, visit ourgrandfathersgrainelevators.com. And Ronald Ahrens, thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. I really appreciate the time.